This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further, literally. They cover all things travel finance, like which travel cards are actually worth the annual fee and which just look shiny, how to plan group trips that don't bust your budget or your friendships, when to book peak season trips without paying peak season prices, and more. So travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Today we're joined by Chris Hutchins, the creator of the chart-topping podcast, All the Hacks, and one of the most detail-oriented minds in the points and miles world. Chris has a gift for breaking down complex strategies into practical steps you can actually use, from deciding when to use cash versus points to uncovering the best ways to stretch your travel budget without sacrificing the experience. We're talking big picture philosophy and deep, actionable tips. And if you stick around until the end, you'll hear his favorite hotel and Airbnb hacks that could get you upgrades, perks, and savings you didn't even know were on the table.
Imagine pursuing your dreams of exploring the world's most exquisite destinations without the extravagant price tag. This is the Revolutionizing Your Journey podcast, hosted by DeAndre Koch, founder of Boldly Go and an expert in financial planning as recognized by Forbes. This podcast is your bridge to a world where travel savvy meets luxury. With DeAndre's unique financial planning perspective, you'll glean insights on making the most of credit card loyalty points and miles for travel that doesn't just move you, but takes you places that you may have never thought possible. Expect the most up-to-date credit card strategies for points and miles, stories from successful professionals on how they integrate travel into their busy lives, and other captivating stories from around the globe. Whether you're a seasoned traveler or just starting out, join us in exploring the best of global travel and learn how to experience nearly free luxury travel around the world yourself. Your journey transforms here, igniting our revolution in the world of travel.
Welcome to the Revolutionizing Your Journey podcast. I'm your host, DeAndre Koch. As always, a quick reminder for those that are watching this episode on YouTube that we do have a audio-only version that comes out every Friday. That is our quick hit, so that's our quick up-to-date points and miles and travel news. And for those that are listening to this in audio format, that we do have the full video of this posted to YouTube every week as well. Now, I am super, super excited for today's guest, because we have Chris Hutchins with All the Hacks. And if you haven't heard of All the Hacks, it's a podcast that last year had over a million listeners alone. Chris was introduced by Emmanuel with Card Pointers. If you remember, that was a fantastic episode. And so, Chris, I'm super excited to have you on the show today.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be here.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Chris. So we're going to talk about all sorts of things and get into all the hacks, essentially, when it comes to points and miles and travel. Maybe not all of them, because this show's only but so much time, but we're going to get into a good amount. But before we get there, can you tell us a little bit about who you are, where you live, what do you do for a living, and then how did you get into the world of points and miles?
Yeah, I might change up that order. So I've been a nerd about points and miles for a while. I have pictures of myself flying in business class for my dad's points when I was a kid, like, you know, drinking a bottle. So I inherited the love of this from my dad, who had been playing the points game and the travel game forever. And now for a living, this is my job. Like, I create the podcast and a newsletter on travel, points, miles, deals, life. I'd say it goes a little beyond that, right? Like, we've done episodes on optimizing every area, whether it's health or sleep or, you know, your relationship. But my heart came into this from the points and miles world, and probably also from the personal finance world. And so before this, I was at a company called Wealthfront, which acquired a financial planning firm that I had started. So we share that in common.
Absolutely.
I'm a huge, you know, nerd about optimizing everything in my life. And money's a big one, from, you know, dialing in all the right levers and investing to kind of anywhere you could take that path. love saving money, of course, which I think will probably be a common thread amongst anyone listening to this show. And so I live in the Bay Area, have been here for almost 15 years now, and love being close to an airport that could take me almost anywhere. I guess LA and New York might have a few more destinations, but pretty good spot. So yeah, I think that's me.
That's awesome. And as we're talking before we started recording here, it's not a lot of individuals like us in this space. There's plenty of people that are in the points and miles space. There are plenty of financial advisors out there. And I know you're not practicing anymore, but the fact that you have the background of like connection with money, but super analytical and able to kind of blend that into the points and miles space, I think is huge. And what was the trigger to go from, well, financial advisor, having your own practice to full-time with the podcast?
Well, the financial advisor full-time was really actually more, I've lived in Silicon Valley. I've started a few different companies. I've done that game and I've always loved helping people optimize their life. And so I was trying to think of what company that I wanted to start. I was in this entrepreneur in residence role at a venture capital firm at Google. And everyone always asks me, how do I just dial everything in like you do? And so the creation of the financial planning firm was really, I had a bunch of friends that had some money, but had no clue what they were doing, weren't sure if they were on the right path. And they were like, you seem to understand this. Can you help me? And so I thought, gosh, what's the best way that I could help someone in that situation? And then I thought, oh, maybe I could start a financial planning firm. And so that's what I did. And ultimately, that's a really hard business to scale as a software venture-backed company. So we found a home at Wealthfront. I spent a bunch of time there, but I never lost that itch of how do I help people dial in and optimize all the aspects of their life. And so while I was at Wealthfront on the side, I thought, gosh, I kind of liked being a guest on a podcast. What if I recorded some episodes? So I just tried it out, recorded, put out 8 episodes, and it worked. And people liked it. People came back for the first 8. And I said, well, I guess I'll just keep doing this. And so I kept doing it until it grew to the point that it became enough of a business that it could be my full-time job. And so I quit my job at Wealthfront and I came and started doing this full-time and have been doing that probably for 4 years total, but probably 2 years full-time on the podcast.
Very cool. Very cool. And I know I have friends, I have people on my team, people that work with our practice that if they're hearing this, no, I'm not giving up the practice for a podcast. I got to throw that out there. I'm not going to follow the same journey there, but we can dive deep into the points and miles space, both from an analytical standpoint and a high level standpoint. And Chris, one of the things I think that impresses me the most about you is the fact that you will dive deep and you'll go into layers of depth that probably most people don't care to go to, but that's how they're able to learn from you. So I'm excited to extrapolate some of the knowledge that you have in the points and miles space and just kind of thinking high level with points and miles, very simply, because I know there's people of all levels when it comes to points and miles that listen to this podcast. So this could be their very first episode. And for another person, they can have been following from the beginning and have been in the points and miles space for a while. Very simply, how do you decide whether to use points or pay cash for a trip in general?
Yeah, and this has evolved a lot. Yeah, I never answered how I first got into points and miles, but it was I wanted to go to Mexico with a bunch of people in college and I didn't have the money. So like, how did I decide to use my points? Well, it was really easy back then. I didn't have money and I wanted to go and I did have some points, so I used the points. I don't know what the cents per point was. It was irrelevant because I didn't have any money to take the trip if I didn't use them. Now, I think I'm in a place where I have the choice, right? If I want to go on a trip, I could pay for it or I could use the points. And I'm probably not doing the most optimal version of this, given that I probably have 10, 20 million points right now. And so I should probably use them more. But in general, my logic is, am I getting a deal that is, you know, a better use of points or not? If a flight is $500 and it's, you know, 500,000 points, of course I'm going to pay for the flight. Like, you could argue that I have enough points that I should not pay at all, but I can't get such a bad deal, you know? So it's got to beat cashing out my points and just buying the flight with dollars, which I kind of value that at, you know, up until recently, probably 1.5 cents. So I was like, if it's going to be 1.5 cents or less, maybe 1.3 cents or less, I'm definitely going to use cash. And if it's going to be more than that, I'll use points. But sometimes that math doesn't work really well, right? Sometimes you're looking at a business class flight And you're like, well, it's not fair to say that I would really pay $20,000 for this Emirates first class flight because I never would do that. So I try to adjust it for what would I actually pay for it? Like, is this a good deal? And would I actually, like, if I'm thinking cents per point, I'm trying to figure out what a reasonable one is. But I would say in general, 2 cents and above, 1.5 cents and above, I'm probably using points. Below that, I'm not, unless I'm trying to chase status or something where I just need the paid flights.
Well, I got to take a step back, though, because you just said something that might have left the listener's jaw on the floor, which is I might have somewhere around 10 to 20 million points, right? And so when they hear that, I could immediately start thinking the question goes, then why do you even care about cents per point of value? Like, if the business class flight is 0.1 cent, you've got enough points plus extra, you can buy the business class ticket that's 300,000 per person one way that we would never want to do in general. Why do you care so much still when you have a bank of points so high? Because a lot of listeners are individuals that may only have a couple 100,000 points. They're building. They, you know, they might have had 500,000 and just used 400,000 for a family trip. And they're just like, all right, well, we got to rebuild again till the next trip. I'd love to have tens of millions of points, just like I'd love to have tens of millions of dollars. Why does that matter?
I mean, I probably have a problem. Like I probably need to talk to like a points therapist here. I think at the end of the day, I kind of have a value prescribed. So that 300,000 point one way ticket, you know, if it had to be, then it would, right? Like, but we're planning on a trip to Japan. We've got four of us, and I could, and this is something that I might end up doing, just to be clear, but I could go spend, you know, probably $200,000 to $300,000 a person and just get it, no problem, on exactly the flight I want, four seats. But we managed to find a way to do it kind of booking right as the calendar opens on two seats for, you know, like 70,000 points, which is such a better deal. But we're on two separate flights. So we've got me and my wife are on separate flights, each with one kid, one flying to Haneda, one flying to Narita. And that's not optimal, right? You could say with enough points, I should just get on the flight where we're all on the same flight. And ultimately, I probably will. But I probably will because I'm going to set alerts, and it would blow my mind if one of the two flights we're already on doesn't add two seats or some other flight doesn't have four seats. And so if I needed to, I would. But I think that if you play this game enough and understand how it works, you just never end up having to spend the 300,000 points, especially if you're flexible, right? If I had a job where I could only take these specific days off, it would be a little harder. But we also are coming off of 3-4 years with toddlers and babies. So we didn't travel that much. And so the points haven't been decumulating as much as they've been accumulating. And so I look forward to the day where I have way less points.
I love that. And I think, honestly, the same mindset, again, ascribing some of the financial advisor mindset here, is very similar when I think of my clients that are worth tens of millions of dollars. There's a reason why they're so wealthy, and there's a reason why they keep their wealth, right? There's an efficiency to understanding how money operates and works. And the same thing on the point standpoint, right? You've got the opportunity there. Yes, you could blow your points just like someone could blow their money, but you're still being efficient with the points that you have, which I think is fantastic and a great mindset, because even though you have the bank of points, that you're still looking for the right deal, the right timing. Maybe splitting the family is not as ideal, but you're still taking advantage of, hey, what's the most efficient, optimized dollar that I can get for this flight as it works for us based on what we're comfortable with? So there's plenty of families that wouldn't be comfortable with that. But if you as a family are like, hey, we're comfortable with this, we travel a lot, this is how we do things often, and it's worked for us, well, then you can work within your kind of comfort level, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I also think that my financial journey was very much like a financial independence, retire early, fire like mindset, where it's like accumulate, accumulate, accumulate. And so I think some of that's carried over into the points world. But I've been getting better. Like, just to be clear, you know, the other day we were like, oh, this place, we used like 180,000 Hyatt points for a long weekend. And I was just listening to an episode, and there's a decent chance it was an episode with you and Julia talking about something. I can't remember the exact episode, but somebody was talking about burning 45,000 Hyatt points a night. And they're like, I don't know if I could do that. And I was like, I just did that. I finally did the thing. Like, I'm finally learning to graduate out of that point. But I still love playing the game. Like, I want a deal. I want to get a good value, and I probably need to let go of some of that, but it's why I'm doing this, because I love it.
So in that same light, let me ask you this, Chris. What's been one of your best redemptions ever? And I'm going to let you decide if you're going to go the cent per point value or just this blew my mind, my wife and I's mind, however route you want to go. But what would you say has been one of your best redemptions ever?
So I had an idea of how I was going to answer this, but now I want to give you a different answer.
Okay.
It's totally counterintuitive, but my wife and I went to stay at the Four Seasons Lanai earlier this year. And I was listening to another podcast and someone said, gosh, we stayed at this hotel and it was the best hotel stay we've ever had, especially for a family. And I was like, I want to go to a hotel that's someone who's played, like someone who's done this way more than I have is like, this is the best. I was like, I want to do it. You know how many easy, great redemptions there are to use at a Four Seasons? None. Like, there's no good redemption. So I redeemed that stay with cash. Like, I just paid for it. And so that is not my best redemption, right? It's not the honeymoon where we got 20 cents per point and went to the Seychelles, which we did. Like, that was a great trip. But a very pivotal moment for us was, if we really want to do a thing, can we find a way to not let the points get in the way? And so that was probably our most meaningful redemption. It was a few thousand dollars of cash, right? It was the exact opposite of where I would imagine most people answer this question, but it really helped reframe my brain to stop getting stuck in the world of letting the points decide the trip. It's like, are you deciding the vacation or is the vacation deciding you? Now I've kind of graduated to the point that no, now I want to decide the vacation. Now I think I'm going to be better at using points to say, look, we've decided we're going to Japan. So like, it doesn't really matter whether it's a good points deal. Like, we're going to need to stay in a hotel. And so like, if it's not perfectly optimal use of our Hilton or Marriott or Hyatt point, like, we're still going to do it because we've decided on the trip we want to have. And so that trip changed that perspective. That said, I'd say every year we take one big trip and I'm always trying to make sure I'm getting crazy redemptions, whether it's almost always flying business class over an ocean to stay in some luxury property. Like, that's happened a lot. We recently just went to the new Waldorf Astoria and used 6 Hilton free night certificates. And so I'd say this is a fun one where it has nothing to do with cents per point, but we overlapped the end of June with the beginning of July. And that's important for anyone who plays the Hilton game, because you've got these Hilton credit cards where you get either quarterly or every 6 month credits. So we managed to stack, between me and a couple friends, we stacked like 4 $200 credits in the first half of the year and the second half of the year. So we ended up with like $1,500 or $1,600 of Hilton credit at this hotel. But it was all from credit cards that, you know, was, yes, there's a cost. Yes, we paid an annual fee, but we basically managed to cash out like all of my and some friends' Hilton credits all in one go, along with 6 free night certificates. And so in that case, it was like the points for the flight were kind of insignificant relative to the hotel. And it just felt great. But we decided we wanted to go to Costa Rica. So it's like, not only did we go to the place we wanted to, but we managed to cash out free night certs and all these, you know, Amex $50 Hilton credits. It's just like, let's use every Hilton credit out there. And it felt really great. And it was an awesome stay.
I love that positioning around essentially being free to travel how you want to and not letting points and miles dictate where you need to travel, because we actually are seeing an example of that now with our upcoming honeymoon that's coming up. And before I mention that, I'll say I've always talked on this show that I think the opportunity with points and miles is it can expand your travel budget. If your travel trip budget was $10,000 as an example, most people are probably spending $7,000 to $8,000 of that on the flights and the stay and only leaving a little bit for the food and the experience. Well, what if the flight and the stay was only 20%, $2,000 out of pocket plus points, and now you have $8,000 that you can spend on the rest of the experience? So for us, when we're looking part of our honeymoon, it's going to be Hong Kong, Fiji, and New Zealand. When we're looking at Fiji, there's some great hotels there. We were looking at IHG. There's no Hyatt opportunities. Well, I think technically some Mr. Smith, but those aren't going to really count. And the points redemptions, if they were even there, would be insane. There's a couple SLH properties. We're staying at one of them. But the number one adults only all-inclusive resort is not a points resort. It's pure cash. So one of the things we said is, well, we love adults only luxury travel, all-inclusive travel. I know that's not all of our listeners, but that's something that we do love to do. Well, if we're saving so much money on our flights, we're flying business class, we're doing all these things, we're staying in Hong Kong on points, we have stays in New Zealand on points, we have some dollars we can use to splurge so that we can stay in the best number one adults only all-inclusive resort in Fiji that's not a Hyatt, IHG, Hilton, or Marriott brand. So I really respect that point because it's really important for listeners to know that points can expand your budget and not just limit where you have to travel.
Yeah, I think we often try to put ourselves in that mindset, but it's hard, right? Like, I can't tell you how many vacations we've taken the last 20 years where it's like, well, where will the points take us? And now with all these tools, it used to be actually harder to let your points dictate where you went because we didn't have all these award search tools that said, hey, did you know that there's an amazing deal to go to Chile next weekend on your points in business class? Like, if you really want to get the best use of your points, it's really got to be Chile. And you're like, well, I didn't want to go there, but that's where the deal is. And so I think some of the tools are now making it easier for us to focus on how do I get the best value? But the best value is like a little bit good value and a little bit the trip you want to take. Like, if you got the best possible deal on a flight to a place you don't care about, like, that's not a good deal.
Right. Absolutely. So, Chris, I mean, I know you've been in the game for a while. I'm curious at this level or this stage for you, are you primarily focused, like, what's your daily drivers? Because especially if you have a large bank of points, are you still focusing more so on the Chase or the Amex or the Capital One, or are you building across platforms, or is it whatever card you've got right now you're trying to hit a sub for is what you're working on, right? Kind of what's been your philosophy at this stage, someone that's built up a huge bank of points that's been in this game for a while?
So the one thing that I think is nice about building up a large array of points in different programs is that I can focus on what's just going to maximize whatever purchase I'm making. That said, I am new to Citi, right? Like, I've built my million Amex, Chase, and Cap One points, but at Citi, I think I have like 100,000 points. I opened a Citi Premier this year, and that was my first Citi card.
Same.
I did open two or three AA cards like 15 years ago. And for like, I think it was like a triple 75,000 point bonus. Like, I all three in one go. And that was it. And then I closed them. Haven't touched it since. So I'm like, oh, I don't have a lot of Citi points. What if I want to stay in one of those LHW hotels or a preferred hotel? Or what if I want that great EVA air transfer? So a part of me is like, well, if it's close, I'm going to bias towards Citi. And all these great subs right now are interesting, but I kind of want a Citi Double Cash card just because I want to focus on getting Citi points, even though I've got a Cap One Venture X business. Like, I've got enough Capital One cards that earn 2X that you'd think it wouldn't matter. But a part of me is like, well, I want a little more Citi points. I don't know why. Like, it doesn't, there are very few reasons why that would practically matter, but I can't help myself. So I'd say where I allocate my spend is primarily on what's going to maximize the earning. I'm not a 20 sub a year. Like, I don't open 20 cards a year. I'm probably a every other month or every 3 months, I'll open up a card. If there's something interesting, like the Mesa card, we own our home. So that was a cool one to open. And I got to spend $1,000 a month on it to make sure I'm getting my Mesa points. So that one was great. That's interesting. 3X on taxes. That's also interesting. So I've been using that card. But I'm not going to use that card to get points if I could get more of some other points. So that's part. The second thing that's changed a little bit is I've started using cash back where it's close. So if you look at the Bank of America platform, if you have Platinum Honors, which requires putting $100,000 either in a brokerage at Merrill Lynch or in a bank account at Bank of America, which won't earn any interest, so I don't recommend that path. Yeah, I mean, it will, but it's like 0.00, you know, so some insignificant amount of interest. You're at 2.625 on everything, 3.5 on travel and dining. Now, if you use those points to buy flights, cash flights, they're worth 25% more. So you can take your 3.5 almost up to 4%, and your 2.625, I think, goes to like 3.28. So that's pretty compelling, like, compared to some earnings. Like, if I'm just going to get 2x Capital One, or I'm going to get 3.2% cash back, like, Like, I'm starting to lean a little bit more towards that because I just have a lot of points, and I could make a case that the next point I earn is probably not going to be used for years, right? Like, so the next point I earn is going to devalue, whereas the next dollar I earn, I'm going to invest straight away and will be earning my interest or earning some form of growth in the market. So when it's close, I'm actually playing around with cash back. I was playing around a lot with the US Bank Altitude Reserve card when I could get 3x on Apple Pay and cash those points out at 1.5. So that was 4.5% on Apple Pay. I'd take 4.5% back over 2x points any day. That goes away in December. So now I'm like, okay, I really got to make sure I'm maximizing that right now. So I'm not afraid to just switch to the cash back world when it's a better deal. Also, it was interesting when we booked our stay at the Waldorf. This is something that I think we often forget about. We think about cents per point. Let me challenge some listeners with some math here. So I was looking at this stay. It was at the Waldorf Astoria. And I think rooms, let's just for the sake of simple math, were $1,200 a night.
Okay.
Now, it was a standard award, so it was 120,000 points. By the way, I think 250 of the next 350 nights are available at that hotel at Standard Awards. It's awesome. Definitely, if you're looking for something, it's a great property. But that means that you could book it with 120,000 points. Now, Hilton points are pretty much always on sale for half a cent. So that means that hotel is $600 a night. So if you're calculating your cents per point using $1,200, you're doing it wrong, because that hotel could be bought by someone with no Hilton points. Just go to the Hilton website, buy Hilton points. They could get the room for $600. So I've been thinking about the fact that a lot of places where I might earn points, I could just buy them and book the stay. So it's like, point cashbacks, maybe not the worst thing in the world, right? Like, or Avianca sells points super cheap. So it's like, if I need more points, you can always buy them. Now, you might not be able to buy them in the exact program you need. There might not be a transfer. Like, believe me, I like points. I'm not trying to steer away. But I think there is an interesting case for cashback, especially when you realize that a lot of points go on sale a lot of the time. And so I've been trying to force myself, at least for 2025, to feel what it's like to just do cashback. But it's still hard for a points junkie to do.
And I love how you mentioned about buying points. We had a fantastic episode and a deep dive with Tommy Lonergan, Travel Like Tommy, who unpacked all the reasons why buying points makes a lot of sense. So I love that you bring that up. I'm curious, at this point of the year, we're basically through 8 months of the year, what's your verdict? You're leaning towards like, I'm liking cashback, but it's still hard. If you had to make it definitive, we're going one way or the other in 2026, from your experience so far, what would you say?
I mean, if I could only pick one camp, it would be the points camp. But I'm increasingly learning that, like, if you don't play the game and you don't use the search tools to get the best deals, and you're ending up at 1.6, 1.7 cents per point because that's your kind of average, because you're just not willing to be as flexible as you want, I think you'd be better off with cashback. I genuinely do. I think especially with the Chase Reserve not giving just a blanket 1.5 cent value in the portal, I think you're now probably going to get to a point that the average redemption of your points, if you don't transfer, is kind of closer to 1 cent, that cash back for the average person might be better. But if you're flexible and if you're willing to play the game and if like you get a lot of enjoyment out of it, like I do, it's always going to win, because I frankly could not spend the $20,000 it would cost to fly to Japan in business class with our family of four. But if push comes to shove and I've got to spend, 500,000 points a person each way, I probably could justify it, even though it's not that far off from spending $20,000. Like, if I look back, like, but it feels a lot easier. I mean, it won't feel easy, right? Like, it would be hard, but it would feel easier to spend 250,000 points each way than to spend $5,000 on a round trip business class ticket.
Hey everyone, quick break from the episode. If you're enjoying the show, make sure you're subscribed on whatever platform you're listening on so you never miss an episode. And if you've gotten any value so far, it would mean the world if you left a quick rating or review. It helps more people discover the show and keeps us motivated to keep creating great content. Also, if you're feeling stuck or want help with points and miles, whether it's picking your first card, planning a big redemption, or even having someone book it all for you, we've got you covered. There's a link in the show notes to schedule a free points and miles consultation. Just fill out a quick questionnaire, tell us your goals, and we'll take it from there. And don't forget, our newsletter and private Facebook group are great ways to stay on top of breaking news, updated card offers, and tips that don't always make it into the podcast. You'll find those links in the show notes as well. Now, back to the episode. Well, Chris, let me ask you this. Shifting gears, we're talking about a lot of the good things and a lot of strategy and efficiency. But I'm curious to know whether this is earlier in your points and miles journey. I know, of course, this world has evolved, or even more recently, as experienced as you are. What's a travel or points mistake that you've made that you think others can learn from? And I've mentioned even on this show some of the blunders I've made, not thinking through or accidentally booking what, or transferring points for what ended up being a phantom booking and all sorts of different things. I'm really curious for yourself, is there a travel or points mistake that you've made that you think could be a teachable moment for someone else?
Yeah, I mean, reading the fine print on a lot of these rules, I think is super valuable. I was in New York, and I had booked American Business or First even from the West Coast to the East Coast for, I don't know, let's call it 50,000 Avios on American. And I didn't realize that you can't cancel Avios bookings within 24 hours. And I had finished a meeting like 4 hours early. And I was like, I just want to get home, hang out with the family. I can make it home for dinner if I just... So I just booked a flight on United, and it was out of Newark instead of JFK. And I'm on my way to Newark, and I go to cancel the Avios booking, and I can't cancel it. And now I'm sitting here thinking, well, I could cancel the United booking. I'm like two-thirds of the way to Newark. Do I cancel the Avios or the United booking, get back on some form of transportation to go to JFK? Which, by the way, for anyone who hasn't thought, like, going from Newark to JFK sounds like it could take the 4 hours that I would save. Like... And so I just decided, you know what, I'm going to do my best at like reaching out and be like, hey, is there any flexibility here? No, there was none. Ate the 50,000 points. Like, it just gone. Like, it's one thing to spend 100,000 when you know that maybe you could have gotten 50. It sucks to spend 50 on nothing, like nothing to show for those 50,000 points. In fact, I spent time trying to get those points back. So it's like I spent an hour or two of my life to lose 50,000 points. It was even worse. So that's happened. For sure, I've let points expire somewhere somehow. I think one of the downsides of trying to experiment with different programs is now you have points spread all over the place. If I look right now, I have points in 18 different airline programs, but like Singapore, I have 1,000 points. Hawaiian, I have 34 points. ANA, I have 350 points. Aegean Airlines, I have 25,000 points that expire next year. There's a chance I forget to use them because it's just a pain. I totally think that I let 10,000 Turkish points expire because I transferred them thinking I was going to book something and it was not working. And now, I don't know, it just seems like it's more hassle. So the transferring points to different airlines or the Aegean thing, there was some promo where if you flew one flight on Aegean, you could get status for 3 years. I don't even think I ever used that Star Alliance status. Like it was a fun thing 10 years ago to try to get this status that resulted in me having 25,000 Aegean points that I still haven't used. So I would say overcomplicating it and playing the game more than even matters has happened a bunch. But really, the cancellations, now that US airlines have made it so easy to book and cancel last minute, I feel like it's made me more cavalier with points and miles. And then I forget, oh wait, I transferred these points to Avios and it was a great use, but oh wait, maybe they won't be that easy to use. Maybe they won't be that easy to cancel. Like, I think that's something that it wouldn't surprise me if I've made that mistake again in the future, because it seems like there's all these great deals and sometimes there's the hassle of now I have, I took advantage of the transfer bonus to LifeMiles from Bilt. So now I'm sitting on, I don't know, 350,000 LifeMiles. But like LifeMiles are a pain in the ass to use. It's not that they're not like usable, they are, but do I kind of regret like taking advantage of that 100% transfer bonus a little bit. Like, it sounds crazy in hindsight, and I'm sure someone listening is like, oh, you don't want them, send me your 350,000 life miles. But I think sometimes you can go too far down this path. And if I was just sitting on all United points right now, it's like, I probably wouldn't get all the flights I want, but boy, would it be super simple.
There's so much to unpack there. The first thing I'm going to ask is, I didn't know that you're actually looking and seeing your like points available. What tool do you use to keep track? Like, what's your favorite go-to tool? Or do you literally spreadsheet this like old school style and just say, I got these points here and they expire here?
So I use Award Wallet, which for anyone who uses Award Wallet, I don't know anyone that loves Award Wallet. I know people that think Award Wallet is the best tool we have. I know people that love parts of Award Wallet.
Right.
And all I do is I go into Award Wallet and I sync all the accounts that work with Award Wallet. Then I export it. And then I copy that CSV file and I paste it into a separate tab on a spreadsheet that fills in the main chart I use, where half of the cells are green, which means these came and are synced from Award Wallet. And then the rest are these you need to go manually enter. I'm not using Award Wallet as the store of all of those things. So like American, yes, I think I set up the email forwarding for American, but I kind of like reconciling my points balances on like a end of the month basis. And if that email, you know, hasn't come for 3 weeks, then I'm sitting there on August 1st trying to reconcile how many American points I have, and I can't get to the answer because Award Wallet hasn't gotten the email that got forwarded. So then I just go manually fill it out. So there is no good tool. Like, I'm using Google Sheets, and like, it's not great, but I would say 2/3 of my Google Sheet is automated from Award Wallet.
Got it. And the second question I had for you is, we always talk on this show about not speculatively transferring. Now, again, when you have millions of points, the rules are a little bit different, right? And outside of a scenario like the once in, well, what seemed like it could be a once in a lifetime opportunity to go from Amex to Alaska Airlines, there's an opportunity to speculatively transfer there. I'm super curious, outside of, okay, Bilt had the 100% transfer bonus, which again makes it a little bit easier also, why sling a bunch of miles over to life miles that you didn't already have a plan to use? And I'm asking you this because I know that's what our listeners are going to be asking.
So this was the mindset I went through. I looked at all the Bilt transfer partners, and I'm going to pull up the list right now. So I was like, okay, at the time when this happened, Alaska through Hawaiian was still at Amex. Nobody knew what the future of that would look like. But I looked at Bilt and I said, okay, so what transfer partners does Bilt have? And I had a lot of Bilt points because, you know, I basically, every time I talked about Bilt, I told people in my audience, hey, if you want to support me, go sign up for a Bilt card using my referral link. Those referrals are capped now, but they used to be uncapped. And so, you know, I earned a lot of Bilt points that way. Full disclosure. So I went through the list and I was like, okay, let's ignore all the Avios that aren't BA because it's like, they're all the same. And then I was like, okay, we got Turkish. We've got Emirates, Virgin. Like, gosh, those are all transfer partners of every single other place. The unique ones, United, they're never going to have a transfer bonus there. I've got a ton of United point or Chase points. Alaska was a cool one, right? I'm never going to transfer them to Southwest. I kind of went through and was like, if I had 500,000 Bilt points, or at one point, I feel like it was close to 700,000 Bilt points. I was like, what would I do with them? Like, what's the end game for them? And the end game is probably using these 100% transfer bonuses. And there's probably realistically only 6 times those will ever happen. Right, because it's never going to happen for United. It's never going to happen for Alaska. So I was like, okay, what are the 6 times I'll be able to get 100% transfer bonus? And the next time any of those happen, let's use them. So the next time the Avios one happens, let's sling 150,000 there. The next time the Aeroplan one happens, let's do the same thing. And we'll just throw them out. It probably wasn't even 6. It was probably like 5. I regret not doing Air France KLM, but I can't even remember their expiration policy. And honestly, I don't even think I looked up the Avianca Life Miles expiration. Oh, I did. You can extend them. They do expire quickly, but you can't extend them. So that was the rationale. I struggled with the same thing with Alaska. Like, how many Amex points do you send over to Alaska? My answer, 2 million. Like that. So I was like, let's just sling it. Like, let's go crazy because I feel like I'll never be able to do this again. And I just spent most of this year playing the American loyalty point game solely for the purpose of it being easier to get status that works for Alaska. So, like, we have a ton of Alaska options from the Bay Area. Alaska status was not easy to get on its own. Let's get AA status. Let's book a lot of Alaska. Let's use Alaska points. I think there's a glitch that a few people have reported where you can book a flight using your Alaska miles and then change to American and use your American status to pick seats and all that, but still get the points that Alaska sometimes awards you for booking with points. Like, they're one of the rare programs where you book with points and you still earn elite status. And so I think that that was one thing where I was like, I'm going to use a lot of these Alaska points. But I think I never recommend doing it. Like, I would only do it if the number of points I left in the transferable currency was enough to take care of any of my future travel needs for the next couple years.
Incredible. Absolutely love that. Chris, we've been talking points and miles, but I want to broaden the space to travel hacks in general, right? Because you've had some incredible guests on your show. And I know on your show, you do incredible deep dives into a lot of things in the travel and points and miles space and other things as well, as you mentioned. I'm really curious, what are some of your favorite travel hacks that almost anybody can use in general? It can be points and miles based, but also be great if not, that you think is just some of the coolest things that you've come up with or seen or are knowledgeable about.
So I know you had Julia Menez from GeoBreeze on your show, and I'm sure she talked about how she has this hotel upgrade template. And so this probably won't be too surprising, but I've been collecting data from people that have used it. And if you are booking a hotel directly with the hotel and you're not emailing the hotel just to tell them you're coming, I promise you're missing out. She has a great template for how to do this. So you could search Julia GeoBreeze hotel template. Maybe you have one. Like, a lot of people have created these templates, but it's basically email the hotel, say, here, I'm coming. I'm excited. Would love to, you know, have a great experience. You don't ask for anything. You just kind of let them know you're coming. And I would say it seems like 40% success rate on some special treatment, whether that's an upgrade, free parking, monogrammed pillows, bottle of champagne, all kinds of stuff. So that's one that everyone can use as long as you're booking directly with the hotel. It doesn't work well if you're using an Expedia rate. Like, if you're cashing in your, you know, hotel credits in some travel portal, not going to work well. I think we're in this weird place where many carriers now make it really easy to add on international data. But if you're on a legacy carrier that doesn't make it, or you're on like an MVNO like Mint Mobile and the passes don't work or they're not the right price, eSIMs are amazing. Anyone that's not buying really cheap data is missing out. There's Aerolo, Saily, there's a bunch of products that you can use to go find eSIMs, and you basically can activate data. I think one of the biggest ones is just not overscheduling. I think it's so easy to go on a trip and say, hey, let's make sure that we have this going on in the morning and this going on in the afternoon and this. And then you kind of miss the experience of the country. And so I did this episode with Rolf Potts, who wrote a book called Vagabonding, which was one of my favorite travel books. It probably still is, though I haven't read it in a few years. And he just described this moment where someone told him that they were so annoyed in Paris. And they said, all I wanted to do was go see Paris. Like, I really wanted to feel Paris. I wanted to feel Parisian culture, Parisian people. Like, I wanted the local experience. And he's like, did you get it? And he's like, no, it was so annoying. I went to a cafe and I sat down and the service was so slow. It was as if everyone just wanted to sit there and do nothing. And I just sat there waiting for my food, waiting for a glass of wine, waiting for the bill, people just walking by on the street, all getting to go do stuff. And I just had to sit there and I waited and waited. And it was so frustrating. He goes, that was Paris. Like, sitting at a cafe, leisurely eating your lunch, running into, talking to random people, watching people go by. Like, that is a cultural experience that you were looking for. And you were so caught up in trying to rush to the next thing that you kind of didn't let yourself just live in the moment. And so we always try, especially when we're in cities, to leave 50% of our time, if not more, completely unscheduled. Like, go on a walk. There's a verb, if anyone doesn't know, flaneuring, or you can be a flaneur. Like, it's a traveler who just kind of roams. Like, that is a great example of how we like to travel. And so with kids, it's like mornings, scheduled. Afternoon, let's go to a park. Let's let the kids play in a playground. You know, it seems like, gosh, we spent all this money to go to Paris. Shouldn't we be going to a museum? Shouldn't we be going to a restaurant? It's like, no, we spent money to go enjoy another culture, to enjoy other people, to learn, to experience. And you can do that just as much in a restaurant as you can in a playground. And so leaving that time to wander, get lost, go do things, just roam the streets. I feel like some of those moments are the best moments we've had in places, and they never would have happened if we were overscheduled. Like when we were in Lebanon, in Beirut, I remember we'd been traveling at this point for 4 months, and I just wanted a Dr. Pepper. I don't know why. Like that just, it hit me. I was like, I want a Dr. Pepper. And we were like looking, and somewhere on the internet said there was this like American store that had all these exports. So we were looking for it. We couldn't find it. And this random guy on the street was like, "What are you, can I help you?" And we were like, "We're looking for the store." He's like, "Yeah, store's not there." It's like, "Ah, it's okay." He's like, "But do you want to come over for tea?" And like, we went over to this house of this 60-year-old man. He invited his neighbor over and we sat and talked for an hour and a half. It was one of the best experiences we had in the country. But had we overscheduled our day, we never would have even had it. It wouldn't have even been possible. We said, no, we've got plans. We're going on this thing. So I just love leaving time in my day to just explore and let serendipity take over. And I feel like most of the best experiences happen when you do that.
I'm really curious. So in this time frame, when you were in Lebanon and Beirut, and you said you've been traveling for 4 months, was this before kids? Was this
way before kids.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah, we took an 8-month backpacking trip around the world. We bought a 1-way ticket to South Africa and we kind of just overlanded our way there completely unstructured. And so this was that. So I think that's something, if you don't have kids yet, it's an experience that, I mean, look, you just talked about two twin 4-year-olds going to base camp. You can do it. Like you mentioned that story. You can do anything with kids, but some things are less comfortable than others. And maybe that builds grit in you and your kids, but it also, I can imagine, can be quite stressful. We were on a 50-something hour train ride in Tanzania that broke down and we were just on the side. Like, I don't think that would be a fun experience with two toddlers, just for me. But some people might love it. And people on the train had toddlers. But I would have done a different trip. And that was possible at the time because we didn't have any schedule. We could walk around for 3 hours trying to find the cheapest hostel. I would never do that with kids. It would be crazy.
And the episode you're referencing, I know we were talking offline about that. That was episode 31 with The Restless Crusade. So anyone who's recently joined the podcast that hasn't gone back through the catalog, that was a fantastic one because this was last year, but a year before we recorded, that couple, they had taken their twin 4-year-old daughters on a hike to Everest base camp, which I think round trip was like 17 days or something like that to get there and back, all hiking through Nepal. And on their Instagram, you can see pictures and like their kids, like with like these tiny little girls, like scrambling over the giant boulder that says Everest base camp. Fantastic stories. But you're right. You can do anything that you want to do, but obviously it's what you feel like makes the most sense for you and your family and such as well. I'm curious, Chris, at this stage of travel, as we start to wrap up, are you mostly your points and miles travel? Is it full family affairs? Is it a mixture of just you and your wife and sometimes you and your whole family? How do you kind of navigate the type of travel and trips that you're doing nowadays? And you said you do one big trip each year. Is that the whole family or just kind of a couple's thing?
No, I think my parents are kind enough to offer to watch our girls that basically for no more than one weekend a year. They're like, if you want to add some weekdays, great, but we don't want to do 2 weekends in a row. So, you know, usually that looks like a 6 to 8 day trip that my wife and I can take together. And so, you know, this year we went to Costa Rica. Last year we went to the Olympics. We've done Bora Bora a couple times because it's probably just so easy from the West Coast and it's incredible. But every other trip's with the kids. Like we took them to Europe. We're taking them to Japan. Like we try to take them. And I think they're now getting to an age that we're pretty much done with naps. Naps is the big killer, in my opinion. If you have a kid that doesn't nap on the go, which we do, like the whole afternoon shot. It's like, how much time do you have to go experience a city when you've got to wake up and then you've got to be back for nap and then you've got to eat at certain times of bedtime? It's like, it's tough. But once your kids get to 4, 5, 6, whatever age they're kind of done napping and they can stay up a little later, I think you get a lot more opportunity. And so we're just entering that. And I imagine that it might not be crazy for us to burn a ton of these points next summer because kids are out of school. We're going to try to take some time off and just go travel with them. So that'll happen. Before we go too far, I want to come back to one more travel tip, which for people who know this, you're going to be like, of course. For people who don't know this, I don't know why it took me so long to learn it. You can negotiate on Airbnb. Sounds so obvious. I was talking to this host and he was a friend of mine. And I was like talking about something. And he's like, oh, did you negotiate? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, I don't know, 50% of the bookings I do are at prices lower than the list price. I was like, what? He's like, yeah, people negotiate. And like, that's just the game. Which makes me think, if all of these hosts out there are all getting negotiated with, then they're probably setting their prices knowing that. Like, if it's really that common, then if you're on Airbnb paying full price, sure, there are some properties where I'm sure that's just the game. Like, you just have to pay full price. But I know of at least one property where 50% of the bookings are negotiated. In a marketplace where 50% of anything gets negotiated, the prices inflate their way up. So I think now if I'm booking something on Airbnb, I'm the sucker if I'm paying full price. And you can optimize this a little further looking at the calendar. If you're trying to stay for 4 nights and you've got 6 places you want to stay in, find the place that's literally booked up until right before you come and right after, where if someone were to book a 2-night stay in there, that's probably all they're going to get, right? But if you're going to fill the gap exactly what they need, all of a sudden you're going to be the best booking they can get and say, hey, I've been looking at some other properties. Some are cheaper. I'd love to stay at yours. Could we do it for this price? Maybe it's, you know, 25% off. You decide what you want. I'm just blown away that it works so well. Like, I've had success almost every time just reaching out and asking. Now, I hate to be the, like, I want the cheapest. Like, I don't want to drive to, you know, give me the best possible deal. I don't want to spend my time that way. But I'll throw out a price, especially if it seems like overpriced for the neighborhood, but I like it better for whatever reason. Just ask. Worst thing they can do is say no. Like, you can always book it for the rack price later. One time I was emailing with this person and he had 2 properties and I was trying to negotiate on one. And then I realized the other place was incorrectly priced low. And then in the process, he realized it changed it. And I actually would have been better off if I had just booked it up front because he had priced his place too low. But other than that, it's always resulted in a savings.
That's absolutely incredible. I'm actually thinking, so I own an Airbnb, I have a condo down in Mexico, and a property manager actually handles it, so I don't deal with any bookings. But just thinking through, if someone's like, hey, we want to stay here, you know, instead of whatever it is per night, $150, $200 per night or whatever it may be, depending on the season, like, you know, can we do this for $25 less per night? I mean, unless it's peak season where it's going to be booked super often, it's probably sitting empty otherwise. And so, yeah, 100%. Any day, I would 100% take that day. Say, take that deal. So I'm like so impressed by this, because you're right. Like, right, for people that know this, it's like it's a no-brainer. But if no one's ever said this, you're like, what? I've booked Airbnbs for VRBOs all the time. I'm curious, are you negotiating this like directly in the app via messaging? Or are you emailing? How are you typically, what's your process to do this? I'm super curious.
I'll just email them an Airbnb and they'll send a custom offer. One time we went to London and we rented this place and it was just a mess. Like, the heater didn't work. It was winter. It was just gross. And so we wanted to stay somewhere else and we were trying to work with the host, and the host was fed up and was like, you guys just need to leave. And we ended up using that Airbnb cover policy where we emailed Airbnb or we called them and they booked us something else. And what they booked us, because it was the holidays, was so much nicer than what we had, or equally as nice, but so much more expensive. And I really appreciate that. Like, I appreciated that insurance policy, because unlike a hotel, if something happens to the Airbnb you're supposed to stay at, it's not like they have 4. Now, sometimes a property manager might, but usually you're kind of out of luck. So I like the protections that come from booking through the platform. So I'm okay eating that 10 or 12 or 15% fee, which, you know, I would probably save if I go off platform. I will say, if you take the lead photo on Airbnb and you copy it and you go Google image search, you can often find that same property other places. And so if you're finding it in another place that's like a villa rental service in Cabo, you might be better off just renting from the villa rental company than Airbnb. And if there's a problem, they probably can help you find another villa in their network. And so you could probably be okay. So I will book off network sometimes, but if I like that protection in some circumstances also. Just the other day, I tried to ask this guy, I was like, hey, can we just do this off platform? Like, you're losing, you know, 14%. Like, someone's losing 14%. And he was like, nah, I don't. He liked the insurance also. He was like, I like knowing that if you destroy my place, Airbnb is going to step in and cover that policy. So I don't know. I'm okay doing it because I'm pretty confident that I'm not going to destroy everything and need that insurance policy, but I'm also fine paying the fee.
That makes sense. I love that feedback and that advice because, again, this is actually eye-opening for me as well.
Chris, actually, hold on. I just thought of this because I emailed the guy and said, I think the whole stay was going to be $2,000. And I said, well, you know what we could do? What if you gave me the place for $1,000 and then I sent you like 800 on the side, right? Like, so now we're still booking on the platform. You've still got your insurance. I've still got my insurance for the property, but half of the payment will go off platform and half of it will stay on the platform. And so we save the Airbnb fee for half of the cost. And he was like, that sounds complicated. And I was like, it was worth a shot.
I mean, I love the negotiation though, right? Like shooters are going to shoot. Like you got to shoot your shot. So I absolutely love that. Chris, before we wrap this one up, I think those are great hacks and tips that you just shared. Any underrated tools or websites you swear by? I know we talked about Award Wallet already. You use that kind of to help kind of compile everything. But just in general for travel, whether it's travel in general, points and miles specific, whatever it may be, any underrated tools or websites that you absolutely swear by? I know you're a fan of card pointers, which Emmanuel is the one that got you on the show here today. But outside of perhaps card pointers, which that is a fantastic episode for anyone to go back to listen to. That was back in episode 78. But outside of that, Chris, anything that you would suggest that you absolutely love to work with?
Yeah, I mean, I love award search tools. You've covered them. I'm sure that multiple guests and solo episodes, you've talked about them. So let's skip over the obvious things. I love this website, travelindependent.info. And I can't speak to whether it's better than any other website. But when we were doing our round the world trip, I found that there's just so much content that feels like it's jam-packed with promotional content, trying to tell you where to go, who's paying for this blogger. Like this person who writes this, I don't even know who the writer is. It's not that they keep it anonymous. I just don't even remember. I just loved the way that they talked about things like, oh, these places are overrated. Don't go here. Like they were just honest. They're like, go here, but don't go to these cities. These cities suck. And I was like, oh, this person doesn't care. And it was just like straightforward. Let me tell you what I think. And they've been around independent doing this. I think they cover over 100 countries. I love this blog. And honestly, I don't even know if it's still up to date, but I still check it every now and then whenever we're going to a place just to get that opinion, especially if you're doing solo travel and you're kind of looking to get off the beaten path. So that was one. I use Flight Connections a lot to find direct flights. A lot of people have done that. The alternative, which I use a lot, which I don't think people do, is Wikipedia. So anytime I'm like, where can I get to from this airport? I just go like Wikipedia SLC. Wikipedia ARN and go to the airport Wikipedia page. And they usually have a pretty up-to-date list of all the routes. And they often say like, this one's canceling here. I don't know who's keeping this up, but it seems like there's someone obsessed with every airport in the world that keeps that Wikipedia page up to date. And I find that sometimes it's easier to just search for the Wikipedia page of an airport and read that, especially if you're on the go on your phone, than try to pull up Flight Connections on mobile. So I'll leave out the ones that are obvious, like go to Doctor of Credit. They've got, like, we all know those things, but those are a few that maybe people haven't used.
Wikipedia for an airport. I've literally never heard of that.
I use it all the time. I would say I search for airports on Wikipedia at least 20, 30 times a year.
Absolutely incredible. Chris, this was fantastic. Where can the listeners follow you, your journey, all the hacks, all the things? I know that's, you can talk about your podcast. I'm not sure if that's also your social media handle as well. So where can they connect with you?
I don't really do social media, so you can look for me there and you can follow me there, but I don't really post anything. The primary two places. One, the podcast is called All the Hacks. You can find it anywhere you're listening to a podcast, which you're doing right now. And every week we put out an episode that's a deep dive on something. Sometimes it's with a guest, sometimes it's not, but I just finished recording today a deep dive on everything Capital One. Like I've read every possible thing you could ever learn about Capital One and did a full breakdown, but we've also done it on sleep, or we've done it on relationships or topics like that. So that's one. And then I write a newsletter every Saturday morning, which is kind of a roundup of all the best deals, news, and things I'm finding, with a section I just recently started adding, which is kind of like what I'm up to this week. So it's like, oh, here's the bonus I just took advantage of, or here's the trip I just took. So I added a little bit of personal flair to the bottom, but the bulk of it is here's all the news in one place, one week. probably synthesized a little bit down, right? Like you're not going to find the $100 bank bonus, but if a bank bonus crosses a certain threshold, maybe it's a few $100, I might throw it in there, you know, that kind of stuff. So that's at allthehacks.com/email. You can find show notes for all the things at allthehacks.com. And basically, if you just search my name or All the Hacks, you'll find a link to everything I'm doing.
Love it, Chris. Before we wrap up, two last questions for you. First question, who else should we have next on the show?
I don't know if you go to any Points and Miles meetups, but the number of people I've met at Chicago seminars or various group events that are not your typical podcast guest. They're not a person who has a social media. They're just a nerd that's gone deep on a thing. The number of people I've met that I wish that I could have just recorded the conversation I had is so high. So I would say if you're going to these events, there's like three or four in the fall, I would say find people and see if you can just collect stories from people on some of the crazy things that people out there are doing. And not feel like you need to find someone that necessarily has an audience. I would say some of the worst performing episodes I've ever done are with the most household names. And like most people know who Tony Hawk is, famous skateboarder. Episode didn't do that well. Like I found that some of the best episodes I've done are with people that don't even have social media, like don't have websites, don't have podcasts. And so I would say my advice is not a specific person. It's that if you have a person that feels like, God, this person would be great, but like they don't have a brand, they don't have a blog, they don't have a podcast, have that person on.
Love it. Absolutely love it. And that's one thing that we've always tried to do is I always try to bring people that I think are highly knowledgeable. There's plenty of people in the social media space that we've had on. There's also been people that we brought on that have been CPAs, doctors, individuals that are in Points and Miles. But again, that's not their platform that they primarily promote. And those are, as you said, some of the best episodes that we have. So absolutely love that feedback. Chris, any final thoughts from you at all? This has been a wealth of knowledge. You've covered a lot of good things, a lot of great things. I've sat back here laughing at some of the things that you've said as well. Learned some things myself. Any final thoughts before we wrap this one up?
I think that covers it. It would be cool, since you talk a lot about financial planning, think about the financial planning aspects of points that you could weave in. Like what happens to points if someone passes away? Like, can you put them in a will? Like that kind of stuff could be an interesting topic that I don't know if you've covered, but it's something I'm thinking about. Oh, I haven't covered that either, but I'm thinking about things that tie into your experience in your day job.
I love that. I love that. I have a couple ideas for things for future episodes, for solo episodes. I might have to throw something like that in there. However, as we were talking, you dive deep. So you do 30 to 40 hours of research on a subject matter before you put out a solo episode. I don't have that type of capacity and time on my end, but I think I can find a couple things that we can continue to dually bring knowledge to those that listen to our shows.
I think that's valuable. I've listened to a few shows of your episodes recently and they've been fantastic. So just keep doing what you're doing.
Chris, I appreciate that so much. And the listeners as well, if you enjoyed this episode today, be sure to follow us on all social media channels, sign up for our newsletter, leave a like, a rating, subscribe to the show, all those different things. Chris, thank you so much again for being on the show today. You've been a wealth of knowledge and it's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. For listeners out there, again, don't forget to like, share, do all the things, and we'll catch you on the next episode. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to the Revolutionizing Your Journey podcast, brought to you by Boldly Go. Hit that follow button so you don't miss out on new episodes. For deeper insights and to level up your travel game with our strategies, make sure to follow us on our social media platforms and sign up for our newsletter to stay in the loop. Head over to www.boldlygo.world to learn more. As DeAndre is not operating through this podcast as a fiduciary and/or financial advisor, this should not be considered personal financial advice. The information covered and posted has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The strategies and results referenced on this site, while proven, are not guaranteed. While most who apply the principles referenced will achieve similar results, you may not yourself. Your results will vary and depend on many factors that may be in or out of your control, but include factors such as your credit score, financial status, business experience, etc. It is your responsibility to consume and implement these recommendations at your own risk. We cannot be held responsible for any failure to do so.
Travel doesn't just happen when you get on a plane. I'm Pauline Frommer, and on the Frommer's Travel Show, we explore not just where to go, but how to bring travel into your everyday life through books, shows, and stories that shift your perspective, plus insights on smart destinations, timely trends, and interviews with the people shaping the way we explore. Find us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or voyescape.com.